In today's episode,
a lot of the kids that are coming through now can DJ, they can rap, they can make the beat, they can shoot the video, they own their own channels and like have like some basic semblance of business. Like, so they're like a super human artist, one package, one person. And what I'm trying to promote is like, don't give away any of that. Keep that and develop that and find people that you can plug into and work with to maintain that as strong as possible.
This episode is brought to you by Send In Blue. Are you ready to grow your audience and revenue? Send In Blue is an all-in-one marketing, automation, and email platform empowering small businesses to build stronger customer relationships. Create personalized emails, captivating SMS campaigns, custom landing pages, quick sign-up forms, automated workflows, and more. Do it all with Send In Blue. Join the party. 250 million emails sent every day, 400,000 users in 160 countries, and $0 to get started on our free account. You can also use the promo code CREATOR, that's CREATOR, CREATOR, to get 1 month free on their premium account. So go to sendinblue.com/creator. That's sendinblue.com/creator. Make sure to use CREATOR at checkout. All right, welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. I have a very, very special episode today. I have my boy from home. This is Elijah. Elijah, welcome to the show, man. Good to have you on.
Thank you for having me. East London, local lads.
There we go. Link up finally, exactly. Well, the funny thing is, so we actually haven't met in person. So this is a crazy kind of like internet coming together. But like you've been involved with music for a long time. So I knew of you guys like York, you know, Elijah and Skilliam, right? Like that's the what a lot of people know in grime music. Like we would have heard of it. And then we started just talking on Twitter because I think you were listening to my other podcast, Not Investment Advice. And I saw, oh, you working like you were in music, but I didn't know straight away it was the same person, sort of thing. So we were just talking in DMs. Yeah, and then I was like, oh, what do you do? And then you were like, oh, yeah, I do this stuff in music, and I work with this guy, and I was like, oh, wait a minute. And then I put two and two together, and then we both realized we also went to the same sixth form college. So for Americans, people who aren't from the UK, it's like 16 to 18 years old before university. You do like A-levels, and we actually overlapped in the same school, essentially. We had mutual friends and stuff like that, but we didn't know each other back then. So yeah, pretty cool to have this all come full circle, man.
Definitely. And I actually listened to the podcast before Not Investment Advice. I listened to Creator Lab before.
Oh, you did? Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah. So I think I was like maybe searching for someone, and they had an interview on the podcast. And then that's how I first kind of came up. Like YouTube is like my main thing. Yeah, that's my learning.
That's good
device,
to know. So. That's good to know. That's where you found it. I didn't realize. Yeah, that's the long tail right there, man. You know, that's why I put it on YouTube. Maybe we'll get into some of that today. All right, but let's paint a picture of who you are, man. For people who don't know what UK grime music is, or you know, even just the music scene. I know you don't just. It's not just grime for you, but like the whole kind of world of UK music and a bunch of other stuff you've been doing nowadays. So like, yeah, who is Elijah, man? Like, what is it that you've been working on for the last 10, 15 years that people have kind of got to know about you?
Yeah, so I'm from East London, and I grew up in like a kind of like Jamaican household. So my parents both from Jamaica, listen to sound system music, and grew up with pirate radio. So that's like our local broadcasting, highly illegal situation where you would play music that's not available on commercial stations. So that'd be like dancehall, reggae, then like jungle, like fast BPMs, like hard music, then UK garage, and then eventually like the kind of birth of grime happened in that era too. And just as I was growing up, I was kind of exposed to that, and then bought records and wanted to get involved, start DJing. But at the same time, it was like in the transition of, you know, vinyl records kind of collapsing, and then like the internet, not Spotify even, Kazaa, Napster,
Lime
all these
Wire.
Things starting.
Yeah.
LimeWire, all of those things. So I was like bang in the middle. This is 2002. Downloading stuff from all over the world. Obviously downloading stuff local. The pirate radio then started to come onto the internet. So people would record the tapes, upload them online. And that was like mind blowing because people would be all over the world would get to hear it for the first time. Or the first time in real time. And that was my first kind of internet things, playing around with like uploading stuff and yeah, just like sharing what was happening here in London. And then later on kind of made that official, like started a blog about the grime scene, which is more like a kind of rap-based dance music. That's what, how I describe it. It's like East London techno with rapping. Yeah. And
yeah, let's describe it a little bit, because I think there you kind of went through all the kind of evolution there, right? And a lot of people who nowadays they might have heard of, let's say, like Skepta, or I'm trying to Stormzy, like, you know, very mainstream people. I mean, even, I mean, this might be a controversial take, but even someone like Ed Sheeran, who everyone knows for sure, even though he wasn't necessarily like a grime musician, he kind of came from a similar scene. Like he came through that world. Like he was, one of his first videos to pop off was on SBTV. Like that famous one where he's like playing a bunch of instruments and singing. So like that's the sort of like, the kind of grassroots stuff that was happening. And a lot of this was called by, that's why me and you've probably gravitated to the technology side too, is just not only was it this cool music and culture that we were all living in, but it was also like very technology driven in a way, right? Like in the way you said, like pirate radio, even though we think of that as like very analog and old school, but it was about like, what do we have? We don't have much, but like, how do we get this out to people? And that was the way to do it. And then when LimeWire and Kazaa came around, it was, you know, what was his name? Soulja Boy did. He would like rename the yes. MP3s. It would be like Nelly Ride With You or whatever. And it would actually be his song playing when you downloaded it.
Yeah, so there 50 Cent was in the club. And that's 50 what
Cent
it
in the
to,
club. Right? Exactly, exactly. So, but let's go into that a little bit, because the music you just shared, because a lot of people who've actually heard of grime music now think of it as just like UK rap, which is kind of true, like it's a kind of faster rap, there's a lot more like punchlines and stuff like that, but it, like you said there, you came from Jamaican household and it was sound system culture, right? Like, because from my understanding, like grime actually comes as much from sound system culture as it does from just rap. So could you explain like what sound system culture is, because I think it's quite a unique thing a lot of people don't know about.
Yeah, so if you try to think of like first principles of reggae or something, but if you yeah. even if you just start at Bob Marley, for example, the kind of way they would organize playing music in Jamaica was, on sound systems. So trucks, there wasn't like clubs and infrastructure or concert halls in that way. So they would pull up to the block and pull up and party outside, and different brands and studios had their own sound systems. So this is like vertical integration. So they would record, cut the records, and then play, you know, the DJs from that studio would play that music and, you know, have their own style, own musicians, own kind of team. And that kind of like is like the modern or the old school version of like what a rap crew would be. Like, so you have all the records, the musicians, the studio, probably distribution as well, selling alcohol. It was like everything in one. It was like the early version of what a rap crew would look like. Imagine like Wu-Tang Clan, but in the street in Kingston, of a truck yeah. in Kingston, Jamaica in the 50s and 60s, like crazy.
And then the other thing, to add to what you're going to say, the other thing that I think of when I think of grime and what I've seen videos of in Jamaica, let's say, is like this live event like you just described there, but like battles, right? And like in hip-hop we know a lot about like battle rapping, like we've seen Jin the MC rapping on 106 and Park yes. or whatever it was back in the day, and like, you know, we've seen 8 Mile, that's probably a better example actually, right, with Eminem. But in grime raves, like, or like, you know, parties basically, this was a thing, right? You've got like two crews essentially, like there's a DJ and there's rappers and they'll be battling each other in a very similar way. But a lot of that comes from, like you said, like the Jamaican style of doing it, because there's like reloads. Like, so could you explain what a reload is? And like, you don't really get that in hip hop in the same way that you do in like grime.
Yeah. So it is a very like live music. So that in the rapper's role in this thing was like a host. And then they started writing lyrics as well. So it's like trying to get the best reaction out of the crowd. And I guess that's where clashing started. It was like, I'm going to get a better reaction than you, rather than like necessarily dissing you. Like that is more like maybe a rap thing. It was like, I'm going to get the best reaction to my lyric and the sing back. And then if it gets to this peak euphoria, then the tune starts again. Like that's where the reload comes from. And yeah, it's kind of fascinating that we still have that in our music culture here today. That's across all, pretty much all UK club music, a reload is common now. Like, so a lot of people will come to the UK and they're just so confused when the music stops. They're like, what the hell?
That was the best part. Why did you let it go? Exactly. And because I remember even in one of my favorite shows on, like, I guess it's YouTube really what I think of it as, but it's really a radio show, Fire in the Booth, which is also a UK staple for a long time. A guy called Charlie Slough on BBC Radio 1, I think it is. Or is it Radio 1? BBC Radio 1? Yeah. But just the fact that I had to ask what radio station it is, but I knew it's on YouTube, is kind of an interesting thing, what we're going to get into in a second. But one of my favorite kind of freestyles on there is a guy called Rich 32. And there's a time where Charlie Slough, the DJ, just keeps, like, stopping him, and, like, he's reloading it. And if you don't know what that history is, you're like, why is he stopping this? He's on a roll, like, just keep it going. But anyway, so, yeah, thanks for that little kind of history lesson. The other thing I also wanted to just dive into there is the you talked about jungle and garage, you know, UK garage and then grime, because I kind of, like, grew up in the same time as you. So we went from listening to, you know, like, So Solid Crew and, like, Craig David, right, like that era of music. And then out of that, like, So Solid Crew was kind of the harder version. I don't even know if you count it as UK garage or what. I don't know how you distinguish it.
Yeah.
It's garage, right? But there was rappers and singers, right, like Lisa Mafia singing the chorus, and then you've got, like, Romeo doing his 21 seconds, like, bars, right? And then out of that, I feel like just came this new music, which was, like, grime. So, like, where was, because you were in the rooms when this happened, right? Like, you talked about pirate radio. Like, I remember Deja Vu was, I would have to go in my dad's car, and, like, we'd be outside Kelmscott Leisure Center in Walthamstow, and I'd be, like, listening to it in the car, and he's like, what the hell are you listening to here? And then I would be trying to you could call a phone number back then, or, like, leave a message, and they would shout you out. And the reason I'm bringing up all these things is because we're going to talk about, like, the future of music and how the internet enables stuff like that. That is essentially live streaming on Twitch now, yeah? Or YouTube. Yeah, yeah.
Like, the missed call was a tweet. Like, I guess
missed call was a tweet, exactly. Or, like, a heart emoji or whatever. So that was kind of... Yeah, when you were the kind of part of this, right? Like, so when did you guys actually start calling it grime? Or, like, where did that actual name come from?
Yeah, so the name comes from, like, grimy garage. So it was, like, the harder end of, like, garage was, like, a kind of house music of UK. So, yeah, imagine, like, sped up house with, like, reggae bass lines. That's how I would describe UK garage to someone that doesn't know anything about it. And then when you add the, I guess, MCs on top and people start talking about, like, wild stuff, then that end of it became, like, grimy garage and then grime. But people weren't describing their music in this way either. So it's like a journalist thing. It was like, oh, well, we're just doing tunes or running sets. And, like, there wasn't, like, a name for it for a long time. Like, Wiley has this song, What Do You Call It? And it came out in 2004. And he says all these names of genres that people are calling the music, but he doesn't actually say grime. So he says, what do you call it? Two-step. What do you call it? Garage. What do you call it? All that stuff. But he doesn't actually say grime because the word, you weren't using that word at that time. So it became probably grime in, like, 2005-ish.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And so anyway, I think we could probably talk for, like, 5 hours about all this time, and maybe we'll do that in our own personal time for social reasons. But I just wanted to paint a picture, because a lot of people listen to this are, you know, not from the UK. And even if you're from the UK, honestly, a lot of people don't know about this kind of history of it as well, even if it's become quite a popular music scene now. So, like, the reason I, like, you know, the podcast is about entrepreneurship and, you know, creators, people who create things. And for me, like, looking at someone like yourself, you're, like, the perfect representation of that, from both a creative standpoint on the music side, but also on the business side. Like, you talked about starting a blog, and then eventually I think you turned it into, like, a record label as well, right?
And yeah, that's right.
And, like, parties and events, live events. So, like, I think you kind of embody a lot of the kind of traits that I'm always looking for when I'm doing these sort of interviews. So, like, take me back to that time, man. Like, you're in the room, you're there with all these now legendary people that I've looked up to for a long time. I know you've worked with someone like Kano. You had DWE just come to your event that you did last week. These are people that, like, I'd watch on TV, and I was like, man, these guys are just so so talented, like from a, you know, and I just felt like the US didn't ever get to see that until more recent times. So yeah, what was it like for you to find that lane? Because you were saying you started DJing, which is obviously a natural progression, but a DJ doesn't always start a blog and then turn it into something else. So like, what was that transition point for you?
I think it's like two things. It's like that's the language I was just dealing with day to day. I was on MSN. I was on like, other internet blogs like that were already in operation for other kind of music that I followed and for Grime too. And I was like, okay, how can I contribute something that's going to be useful? And a lot of the scene wasn't online as well at that time. So it's just things happening in real life, record shops, raves. There wasn't like loads of photos or videos. So I was like, okay, that I can add that layer to it and like bring some value. Like, I think the DJ culture in Grime as well at that time was like the people were so good. I was like, I can't compete with like these people. Like, we all grew up on this DJ called DJ EZ, who's like a garage DJ. And he's one of these people that were so good that you're like, I can't DJ. If that's DJing, it's long. Like, if it's like watching only football you've ever seen is like Messi, you think, you know what?
I'm not really trying to compete with that. Me. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, fair enough.
So you're just trying to do something different. And then I guess at that time as well, the reason why we did a lot of things by ourselves is because there wasn't like, you know, corporations investing in the music in that way. So it's like, if you wanted to see the thing, you had to make it happen. And it was really difficult because there was like rules and laws and stuff about black and brown people gathering this thing called Form 696.
Yeah, I was going to let's talk about this because I remember this happening as like a kid, and we were trying to go to these events, and I remember the one song. I don't know if this is accurate, so you can tell me the history lesson here, but there's a guy called Lethal Bizzle who I think you might have even gone to school with or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of like, especially in our part of East London, he's kind of legendary already by this point because there was a crew called Morphy Crew before, like, the song Oi is basically the same. It's basically, if I need a hype song, they're still my hype song. Like, I listen to it. I almost listened to it before this, right? So like, he was like the ultimate hype man in a way. And then he had this song called Pow. It was actually called Forward Rhythm, I think, originally. And it kind of, people call it Pow. But that got like banned, right? Like, you couldn't play it in a party for a while because people would just go crazy. Like, you would start the equivalent of what is like a mosh pit in other types of music. Like, people would just start pushing each other, but it's kind of in a fun, aggressive way. And like, you kind of knew when it came on, if you don't want to get pushed around, like, just go to the side for that song and sip on your drink or whatever. But it was quite funny, especially like if there were guys and girls like dancing to Sean Paul and then all of a sudden this song comes on, it was just guys just straight away just change and just let out their aggression, essentially, right? Like, let out whatever it is. But I remember that getting banned, and then later there was another guy called Giggs. He was banned from like performing and stuff like that. So, but I didn't actually understand what was really going on. So for someone who was actually putting on these parties, what was this form? You said 696, was it?
Yeah. So the form was for promoters. You had to fill out, and effectively it said, what kinds of people are going to come to this event? So by ethnicity. So if it was going to be black and brown people, your event would be like deemed high risk. So it meant
it would literally say that though. Like, the question would say, like, do you remember like the wording of the question? That seems quite pointed, obviously.
I think that's what it was. I think it was like, what is the majority ethnicity of your audience?
Majority ethnicity, okay.
And if, so if you said, all right, black or brown, or anything non-white, then it would be deemed high risk. And then it's like, another thing that they had is it live performance or is it going to be DJs and MCs with backing tracks? So they could filter out without saying, is it going to be a garage event or is it going to be a grime event? Is it going to be a hip hop thing? They could say, well, it's going to be a DJ based thing with rappers, so we don't want that. And it didn't get like as much things cancelled, but it made people just not invest in the space because it was like, so like, you're just going to lose your money. So what happened, a lot of times people would put on stuff and then the police could go to the venue and pull it. And at that time, this is pre-social media as well. So it's not like you could just tweet and say, this event's not happening or something like that. You buy a ticket, it's cancelled. Oh, okay, and then that's it. And then built like a lack of trust between like us and the audience and people that were going. It was weird. So such a strange time. But then eventually they took off the ethnicity part and then eventually scrapped the form by a lot of like pushback. But that took years. It took like a decade. It was still in operation in like 2014.
To think in 2022, like anything, can you imagine like the amount of stuff that gets cancelled today, right? Like when I say cancelled, I don't mean the party getting cancelled. I mean cancellation of, you know, doing something wrong and getting cancelled. Like the fact that this was happening, right? Like I didn't actually know that they asked that specific question. I guess I've heard of it since, but like, and back then, if you told me that, I would just be like, oh yeah, it sounds like something they would do, right? Like when I say they, like police or whoever's policing things, I guess it is the police. Is it police or government? I don't know who.
Yeah,
I guess
it's the Metropolitan Police. Yeah.
Metropolitan Police. And because at that stage, you kind of just accepted, okay, yeah, we kind of get like once in a while, you're going to get targeted, you know, disproportionately, you might get stopped and searched, which was another big thing that happened. And I also want to share, like you said, black and brown there. And for a lot of Americans, they don't realize that when we say brown or Asian, like in the UK, Asian means like what I look like Pakistani, Indian, Sri Lankan, Bengali people, because there's quite a lot of us, especially in London, it's like one in five people. And a lot of us kind of come from similar, you know, like areas, we kind of grow up together. Whereas I say like just, you know, in the US, if you say Asian in the US, you normally think of a Chinese, Japanese, Korean person, and you'll incorrectly call me Arab or Indian, right? In the same way, to be fair, in the UK for a long time, we called people incorrectly Chinese when they were actually something else as well. So just a kind of nuance there to share with people. So black and brown, like that was kind of a collective thing, like being clamped down on. Like, how is that now compared to then? Because like you know, things have progressed quite a lot in some ways. I know there's still a lot of issues, but just from your point of view, having worked so closely to this sort of stuff, it doesn't feel like anything like that could fly anymore.
It happens in different ways, I guess. Like in terms of like events being shut down, like that doesn't really happen anymore for those reasons. But the last 30 years of underinvestment and the people that didn't get opportunities, it's like they didn't get to build their things. So imagine if power is allowed to be played everywhere, then it's like, all right, those artists that were on that song would have made some money and been able to reinvest. And so like the first two generations of grime didn't really make that much money. So it's the survivors of it that, you know, that everyone knows now, that Kano's and Skepta's and Big Nasties and JME's and Lethal Bizzles, all those people, Dizzy Rascal, and people that had really long careers survived, but there was a whole bunch of talented people that didn't make it to the next stage. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, it was tough. And obviously they couldn't sell music because it was Napster era and download era. So they weren't making any money off the songs, and then they weren't making money off the shows because you couldn't really do any. And there wasn't quite like director customer type sales yet, or internet sales. Like no one would buy stuff online in 2006.
I guess the iPhone was just coming out within, was it 2008? I can't remember the date. Yeah. Maybe 2008.
I think I got an iPhone in like 2010. I was like super late with these things. Sorry.
Were you on the BlackBerry life? Was that what you were doing?
I didn't even have a smartphone. Phone. I was broke, man. Like, so.
Yeah. You were playing Snake on your Nokia phone, your 3310. But yeah, no, exactly. I completely get what you're saying. But we didn't actually plan to talk about this, but it just came up. And the reason I'm asking is because I think there's a lot of like societal discussions that happen even in the States where I am nowadays in New York, and you know, in the States as a whole, that talk about this kind of principle in different ways, right? And like this is a kind of tiny example in the grand scheme of things of like when you don't invest in something, like you said, like people are doing it for the love of it, but they don't get to go to the next stage. And then similarly, when people have invested in it, they've gone to the next stage, and there's a multiplier effect, and the industry then supports you, and then you get record deals, and then you get the live events, etc., etc. And so to me, the reason I've always loved this music, not just because I like find it fun to listen to, it's just it really kind of embodies that like spirit of like creating something from nothing. And, you know, and that's all relative. Obviously, we're still in the UK or in the US where you have free healthcare and you get to go to school and we speak English, the language of the world. But still, like, if you tell someone who's growing up in a council estate in East London, you know, like, about that, like, they're like, what are you talking about? I don't have much. So that is exactly where this came out of. It came from those like estates, like Deja Vu. I don't know exactly where it was, but I'm pretty sure it was in like some random abandoned
place.
I'll
tell you where it was.
Right? Okay,
I'll
tell you where it
was. It was on the site where the Olympic Park is now.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, so that they knocked it down for the Olympics. So it's like,
oh wow,
the gentrification story in East London, like, for even just for the Olympics alone, is like fascinating, because you can, our man Dan Hancock's wrote that book about it, and it's called, what is it called?
My head just went blank there as well. Yeah, wait, let me Google it, because I mentioned it on the pod
Inner City
recently.
Pressure, that's what it's called.
Inner City Pressure, yeah, really good.
Yeah, but it's, yeah, kind of, you can hear through the music, like, London changing, and, you know, the impacts of government decisions, like, you know, the Millennium Dome and the Olympics and stuff, people getting pushed out of the areas. And like, I'm very lucky. Like, I live in the area that I grew up in, but most of my friends have had to, you know, move out because to get to cheaper areas or more affordable places. Same happens in New York, right? So,
yeah,
you hear that through the music. Like,
and so, yeah, so we were saying, I didn't realize it was on the Olympic Park, because I remember, and are we allowed to say, I think it says it on your profile where you, like, the area you live in,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
In Walthamstow, right? So Walthamstow is also the place I went to school in that we just talked about. It's also like a really famous market. I hope that's still there. Cool Walthamstow Market. And it's like the longest market in Europe, apparently, like street market or something like that. But it's, if you just to paint a picture, it's kind of like, what if you've ever watched EastEnders or an East End film, like guys selling bananas and saying like £2 a banana, and like the Cockney geezers walking with women with hijab on, and little rude boys wearing like Nike TNs and like zigzags in their head. So it's just like a very unique place that I love. But just to go into that a little bit more. So you guys were kind of in these, in like, let's say Deja Vu was one of the early pirate radio stations. Could you, let's go into that a little bit more, because I think a lot of people don't really realize like what that actually means, right? Like, why does anyone need a pirate radio station in the first place? Why can't you just apply for, you know, become a normal radio station?
Okay, I don't want to go into that, the whole history of pirate radio, but effectively the radio, like the what we have now in the UK, they weren't going to play pop music at all. And then some people went out to the seas, the high seas, on a boat, and playing the pop music. So there's these old school like broadcasters, like this guy called Tony Blackburn, who was on this I think it's called Radio Caroline. Like, don't Wikipedia me, but
yeah.
they literally went out on a boat onto seas, and then they broadcasted into the UK. So they were kind of outside of the jurisdiction of the radio waves, and everyone started listening to that. So then the government, or BBC, they made Radio One as a response to the demand of pop music on the radio. Because before that, it was like a centrally controlled thing. It's like, okay, we're going to listen to the news. You're going to listen to like whatever folk music that we tell you about. But these guys went out to sea and were playing, I don't know, the Beatles and Elvis and whatever was popping at that time. And that tradition has like stayed. So they got brought back to land. Like, they don't want broadcasts from the sea anymore. That's what's called pirate radio. And people in London or in major cities, they worked out, okay, we can get these transmitters, get onto the FM frequency and find the dial and like broadcast. And as long as we can't be detected by the law, we could broadcast for free, basically. It's illegal, but for free. So you would have a low kind of coverage area. So say that you might be able to broadcast just to Brooklyn, and that'd be like massive success. So you could broadcast to maybe 1 million people. Those are the kind of impact those things had at that time. And it was,
you know, how many people would have listened to, like, because it was Deja Vu, and then there was Rinse FM later, right?
Those things have always been there. So like Rinse FM is like 25 years old, or like
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So they didn't start for Grime; they existed pre-Grime, and then Grime kind of carried on the legacy of those things. So Jungle blew up on them, and Garage blew up on them. It was those things always there. But yeah, I guess that. The people that were doing it were ethnic minorities, people that wouldn't get onto commercial broadcasting stations. So you'd have like yeah, my friends in North London would like listen to the Greek station, or yeah, there'll be like reggae stations, or like they're all basically something that catered for really, really niche audiences. But then those musics, because of, yeah, it's like, you know, like back in the day when Facebook first started or something, like if you got something that got 10,000 shares, it was like crazy that you could reach that amount of people just or something organically. And that's what kind of pirate radio was like at that time. Like it was one way traffic. People were like text, not, there wasn't even text. It made missed calling in to get a response. It was really bizarre that I lived through that. I think
that is crazy. And so this is going to bring us on to like the bigger discussion we kind of had in mind, which was the modernization of music and kind of where it's going. So I know you listen to Not Investment Advice, and I know from our DMs, you really got into like the Web3 stuff and NFTs and how creative people can use NFTs and stuff like that. And beyond all just the speculation, though, of course, 95% of it might have been based on speculation, but just more like the underlying technology itself and what it might represent in the future. So like before we get into like what it could look like, could we do a kind of a simple kind of overview of like how the music business has evolved? Because, you know, we went from buying records and CDs to, I guess, illegal MP3s to then the iPhone coming around and like paying, people got used to paying like $1 or £1 for a song and albums and stuff like that. And then now we've got to Spotify. So like, and streaming. So like, how has that changed? Like, you know, a lot more artists than I do. If you look at like a pie chart of how you make money as a musician, how has that evolved over time?
Yeah. So on my small scale, so I started my label in 2010 and we were doing vinyl. So pressing records and selling them into record shops. The year that I started, the two main shops for my music closed. I was like, damn. So I started like a Big Cartel and then a Shopify, that, you know, whenever Shopify came here, 2012 or something, and was selling direct. So that was like I was selling the physical product of records direct to people all around the world. That was cool. Then we were selling MP3s at the same time, but the price of an MP3 hasn't changed since whatever, 2007, when it first kind of became mainstream. So that had like diminishing returns always. But the point of it being $1 was just so someone paid instead of not paying. That wasn't like the value of the thing. It was like better than free. That was the idea.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
And then now we have like a kind of all you can eat model, which generally is going to favor like pop stars. But I guess like my level, what has changed is like a one-time sell, like maybe like we'll sell like one MP3, £1, to like more like a recurring revenue type model. So you'll have artists that maybe we get paid like every quarter from royalties, and you're getting kickback from maybe even the same people listening to the song loads and loads of times. And that's kind of, it's kind of nice to see, because you have like this kind of, yeah, like a more, it's not like a up and then down, like you sold a song, then you've got nothing. Sold a song, then you've got nothing. It's more like it's a bit steady. So like a steadier business operation. Like a lot of people hate streaming. A lot of people hate the business model of it. But for the artists that I work with, it's, you know, if something goes really successful, then cool. Then you have like a little spike. But it's been like a bit more of a steady way of like patterning our business. And it's made things in a lot of ways like better than the MP3 selling business, to be honest.
That's interesting.
Not financially, but just effort-wise, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think the other thing people don't realize, and we'll get to like live shows and merch and stuff in a second, but just like from my understanding, like most of the money is not made from just the like selling the music or the stream anyway, unless you're like Ed Sheeran or something. And even then, you're doing 50 million a year in like concert revenue as well. But like, Jen, if you just think of as a consumer, like you pay $10 a month for Spotify, or £10, whatever it is in the UK. And I just went and saw Riz Ahmed, who's not, you know, he's an actor and he's also a musician, but like, you know, he's not like known for his music. And I paid, I think, $50 or something to go see him. And it was amazing. It was worth it. But like, we're used to spending $50 on a show or $100 because we go out to eat and we spend that, right? Like it's not, but for some reason, when it came to paying for music, because we got it for free, there was this weird switch. So I think what you just said there was quite an interesting point. But getting to pay something is better than nothing. And I think also as a business person too, if you actually had that on your own you know, Big Cartel or Shopify store, that's even better because you actually own that relationship with that person through email address and stuff as well.
Exactly. I learned that quickly. Like, the actual power wasn't the record sales, the data. So like, we would be able to, instead of me tweeting it, I could just email the people, hey, we've got a new record out, or hey, we're doing a party in London. And those are the people that I was talking to. So I didn't, it's weird, like, our social media wasn't that good, but our email was strong. And I guess the personal relationships that we built with repeat buyers over time became like powerful enough to like not be asking permission from, like, I don't know, someone to write about us or like.
Yeah, yeah. You guys became like known for sure. Like, just, you were like a staple of the scene, right? So, you were talking about music there. If you don't mind me asking, whatever you're able to share, but like, is there like a range of money that, you know, people get paid per stream, or like per 1,000 streams or a 1,000,000 streams, whatever it is? I think you've actually written about this, so I know you probably know it. But
a 1,000,000 streams is around $5,000, like, give or take.
Okay.
So that's into your, maybe your distributor, and the distributor takes a cut, like 10% or something.
Got it.
Yeah.
So 1,000,000 streams equals $5,000. And then, so just for, I'm trying to do like quick math in my head here, but like, so who would be on a scale to get 1,000,000 streams? Is that quite a lot, like, for someone to get to that level?
So 1,000,000 streams would be a artist that, maybe like a new artist that's really hot. Like, they've got dropped a song and it's going viral on TikTok. 1,000,000 streams in a couple of months would be pretty good. For like maybe an established rapper or established kind of bass people, like in the UK, remember the UK is tiny as well, like compared to the US. If someone's single drops and they had like maybe 1,000,000 streams in a couple months, it doesn't look bad, you know? It does. But at the extreme end, I guess, if a song has gone like super viral, for the UK, maybe like 50,000,000 streams is like, that's strong. That's really good.
Especially, is that like a Stormzy level? Like someone like a Stormzy, or would he?
Stormzy, let's see.
Can you see this on Spotify?
So it's open. That's the good thing about Spotify. Was good for these answering these questions, but
yeah,
for artists, it drives them nuts because if something doesn't go as well as they like. It's like, so his Stormzy song with Ed Sheeran and Burna Boy that came out a couple of years ago has got 287,000,000 streams. So that's three of the biggest artists in the world.
Yeah.
On one song. And it's a few years old. So
it's big. Yeah, yeah. So it's still going. So either way, that's making them kind of like recurring revenues going into their distributor or label or whatever if they're signed, and then their cut becomes less. So like that also brings up kind of like independent versus like major labels. So obviously like Ed Sheeran, I'm assuming, is signed to one of the big labels, and probably Stormzy as well. So like, what is the normal percentage split there? Like, is there like a standard in the industry that they get like 20% or something like that?
No, there's no standard. And that's why the music industry is so hard to navigate. There isn't even like a baseline level of standard in anything.
That's interesting.
There's no industry standard. So you have these artists maybe that are on big independent labels and they're getting 50-50 deals. Like, label takes, invests all the money and they take 50% of the profit. Or you have like an 80-20 deal with majors sometimes, like the majors take 20% of profit, artists gets the rest. Or you have deals that are kind of like I don't know what you call it, where if you reach a certain threshold, then their cut goes down and stuff like that. The history of the music business is like ripping off artists and underpaying them. So like, what they will do, this is the last 6-7 years of the music business. If you, let's say your budget is £1,000,000, you would pay that back out of your share of the profit, not out of the overall revenue. So say you've got 20% of the overall revenue, they would make you pay back the million out of the 20%, not the million overall. That's why artists are broke.
So it's not the profit, you're saying, it's basically like revenue. It's like top line.
Yeah, so it's your share. So if me and you are going 50-50 on this pod and we made £1,000,000.
Easy, all right.
To the moon.
Yeah, to the moon.
And we was going, all right, we're going to split the money and we're working with a major. the major would take, like, they take the money for after. How to explain this?
They take it first. Is that what you're saying?
They take
50% straight away off the biggest number. Then we've got 50% left, and then between then we've got all our costs and everything else.
Exactly. And then we get this.
Got it. Yeah, and that's why I think I've seen documentaries where, like, young artists, they didn't realize that they were, like, flying on these private jets and doing all this stuff, and it was just coming off their bill, which is also kind of like a debate for, like, they should be a little bit smarter about that too, in a way. But also, yeah, it was kind of, there should be someone looking out for them when they're like 19 years old, don't know what's going on.
But it's so confusing. Like, say something like, I remember, like, watching the TLC documentary, and they were like, oh, we generated $10 million and then we had to split 200,000 free weights.
yeah.
And you're like, what?
That's crazy. So that brings up kind of like where we're moving into. So just to finish off that last point. So we talked about streaming. That's really good to understand as a baseline. But from my understanding, a lot of the money is made from live shows and even like selling merch, which I didn't realize would actually make a decent amount of money as well. Like merch and different like stuff like that. So do you have a rough idea of, like, again, looking like a pie chart, is there a rough breakdown for like major artists versus others, or is it also kind of all over the place?
Yeah, it's a complete mess. So the artists that I work with, like, are more DJ based, and I guess pre-COVID their income was 90% live or connected to live. So when COVID hit, it was like, oh well, we've got to kind of rebuild everyone's business.
Zoom DJing doesn't really hit the same way. No. Right.
And even like with rappers and stuff, like, they're doing big festivals, selling merch, concerts, all this kind of stuff. It might not be that, say, like, your songs actually stream more when you're touring. Like, you're exposed to more people. They're sharing it, recording it. It kind of creates this
top
cycle.
Top of mind. Yeah.
Exactly. So when the show stopped, the streams of a lot of our music actually went down because people were being exposed to it, like, day to day. It was nuts.
And so you're saying, like, that 90% turns into, like, but it went to zero, I guess, because they couldn't tour. They couldn't do stuff. So,
pretty much.
So what happened to those people in that scenario? Were they able to make money in other ways?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, the guys and girls I work with, we had to pivot pretty quickly. Like, at first, it was just a bit of a break. It's like, okay, we've been going hard for, like, 10 years. Like, everyone was a bit tired. Catch our breath and then really just work out what of the business you want to focus on. I think that was like a big thing for everyone. It's like, okay, what do you want to do? Do you want to be a DJ that's doing 100 gigs a year? Or do you want to be like more of a stay-at-home producer making records for pop stars or for that kind of angle? Or do you want to somewhere in between? There's an extreme end of, like, say, like a Diplo all the way through to someone that never leaves their house. Like, there's some happy medium. So we tried to work that out. And 2020 was like difficult just because we didn't know when things were going to go back on. So we couldn't plan music or tours because it was just, oh, it's going to be open next month or maybe 3 months, maybe 6 months. And it just kept on going. But the bit of luck is all the shows that were canceled in 2020, most got honored. So we knew that once 2022 or whenever the show started, we would be able to just kind of cash in the existing commitments and then we could kind of rebuild from here. So the reason why I've been puffing up my chest the last month or so, because we've done all of the commitments from 2020 now. So I'm like, yeah, all right, now I'm ready for new business.
Nice, man. Right, so that actually brings up, so I'm just going to share my screen. So a lot, most people are just listening to this on audio, but you can click through to YouTube if you want to see this, or just go and follow Elijah on Instagram. Can you see my screen? Yeah. So this is your Instagram. You've been posting for last year or just over a year?
Just over a year now.
You just hit a year, which is amazing. You've already hit 20,000 followers and you've been basically sharing like in this cool format with like a yellow background and like the black handwriting, essentially, like all the stuff you've learned over the years. You're like sharing a lot of that good stuff, but also kind of like future ideas. And that's kind of what we kind of connected on, was like, you're not just like, not there's anything wrong with this, but you're not just like a music guy who's doing just music. You're like really thinking you're quite forward thinking in a lot of this stuff. And you just, like, this is a cool one here from your event. It says, close the app, make the thing. which is like kind of a great philosophy. I think we'll get onto that in a second. But I did want to pull out a few of my favorite ones. This one here, communities, artists, gatekeepers. Let's talk a little bit about this. What's the idea behind this visual?
Yeah, I guess like artists always angle themselves around like trying to get in front of press or get in front of radio. Oh, this DJ is not playing my music. This person is not putting me on the radio. So all these things. And I'm just like, no, like go and find your audience and then people will accommodate you. Like, you have to prove your idea works to people. And then whoever you deem those gatekeepers are, then they start opening the gates. If they are even gatekeepers, they might not even be gatekeepers. Sometimes like people even view me as like, I'm like, no, I have no power. I'm just doing stuff. Like, don't ignore me. Like, when I started doing that myself, like people might have deemed gatekeepers of music, I was like, well, if I just don't listen, it's like the boogeyman. Just like, you just, I'm not looking. He's not there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I thought that was like, kind of helped me anyway. And I guess like when gatekeepers, not lose their power, but I guess like when people are not talking to them, that's what they go to. They magnetize things towards things that don't come to them. Like a lot of like, you know, music, DJs, journalists, all that kind of stuff. The infrastructure wants to find something. They want to discover. They don't want to just play the tune that came to their email or network with the person that wants to network with them. Like they want to discover. So
yeah.
Yeah, that's the kind of angle.
No, and I guess like that's a bigger trend, obviously, over the last like 10, 15 years, direct to consumer, essentially. Like we've seen Amazon do it, obviously, on a large scale, but also smaller like Shopify stores or YouTubers going direct. I mean, that's kind of arguable because YouTube kind of does have some control as well in a way with the algorithm. But, you know, better than having to go to pitch to Channel 4 and exactly. HBO and Netflix and say, hey, I've made this thing. Like, can you put it out in front of people? But I think that does bring up, just to give like some fair balance to it, I think why, obviously, you know me, my background, like I'm all about this. That's why I loved it. But I think specifically for music, why I think it's interesting is because, especially with like grime music, all the stuff we just talked about, pirate radio, LimeWire, selling MP3s direct, vinyl, setting up raves yourself, that we were basically having to find ways to, like innovative ways to find solutions to these problems and hurdles that were put in the way. And I think being like when we were 16 doing this or even 22, like you're just naturally more ready to use the new stuff. And I think what I'm realizing is a lot of people who are now in their 40s, basically, and even older, they don't always keep, and including 30s, like myself, we start like just getting set in our ways. And I'm wondering, like, do you see that a lot in the music world where like people become quite resistant? Because in one way, music is all about nostalgia, right? Like in like this sort of music, it's all about the good old days and the pirate radio and how it used to be. Kind of like football is like something I struggle with. You might know I ran like a big Arsenal website for a long time. And I loved writing about it and sharing it. But then after a while, I would just be like, everyone just wants everything to be the same. And that is partly why I love football too. I love like the feeling of remembering going with my dad and watching a game and like that old school feeling of getting a kebab after, right? But after a while, you're like, actually, things need to modernize too. So I'm just curious like how you're like finding a space for that, because it feels like there's a lot of people are quite resistant to new stuff in this way.
Yeah, I guess this like the whole theme of my Instagram is that things were done a certain way for those reasons of the time, and then they became like traditions. They're not tradition by, oh, we sat down and wrote it on a piece of paper, this is how it's gonna be, these are the rules. And it's like, no, those weren't the rules, those are just all that you had. So like now that you've got a TikTok or you've got a YouTube or you've got a Twitter, use it. And if that might mean you drop out some of the things that were traditional for that music, cool, you've gone on a new path, like, and embrace it. And I guess the reason why I've been more, not forced to do that, but like looked at things in that way is because the business was changing so fast that I was in. And I wasn't, all this time, I wasn't rich or anything. I was making money and doing stuff, but I also knew that it could just be taken away just like that without, you know, like, oh shit, like the new, social media comes out, you don't understand how to use it, don't engage with it at all. then there's a whole section of the audience that might be into what you do that you just don't touch. And I didn't get involved in Snapchat. I don't know, busy, missed it.
It's confusing, whatever. Man. Yeah, it was. I remember reading like a blog post by, this is how I knew I was old. I was reading a blog post by a VC, like a venture capitalist. I think Mark Suster, however you say his name. It's like called Both Sides of the Table is his blog. And he was explaining how to use Snapchat. And I'm like, because I tried it myself and it was not intuitive when it first came out. And I think kind of purposely, like in a way, like when, if you think about all the things that were cool when we were kids, our parents didn't get it. Exactly. Even my older brother, who's 10 years older, he would have been like what you're using Instagram, what he's still using Facebook. And now he's all over Instagram and I don't really use it as much. And my mum's on Instagram now, right? So like, you kind of know how the cycle goes. So, yeah, like how, like you're saying Snapchat there, but like, I guess that brings up TikTok right now. And like, that is the place in many, many ways, not just for music, but in general. If you just look at, for people who don't really follow it properly, if you just look at chart of usage, number of unique users, number of hours used, basically any metric, like TikTok's crushing everyone. And like even YouTube, which obviously I'm a huge fan of, you know, like they're really eating into that video time. I think they're both going to be completely fine, but just like it's really getting to that level. And then we even see musicians like making songs for TikTok pretty much. You can tell from, you know, the type of song, like I don't want to say all the lyrics because I don't want to get cancelled, but Central C is a guy who made a song recently, and I heard it and straight away I was like, okay, this is like, you know, a lot of people don't like it for whatever reason, but I was like, this is funny and it's controversial and it's going to pop off on TikTok, and straight away obviously it like took over. And so like, what do you think about that? Because like one part is like understanding the tools of our time. The other part is like changing like your actual art for a platform. And yes, I'm curious to get your take on that, like finding that balance.
We've always done this in history. Like I just keep on telling people the album is not that old. The album's like 70 years old. The only reason albums exist is because they could fit more tunes on a vinyl and take more of your money. That's it. It wasn't like an artistic decision. Mozart wasn't out here making albums. He was playing in concert halls, getting that bag. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Because there wasn't anything to record
this
on. Part.
This is the clip for the week. There you go. That's hilarious.
Mozart was playing in the concert halls because that was the way to get paid at that time. Then obviously when recording music came in, the jazz musicians were like, like what the hell? Like this is going to take our jobs. Not realizing that you could, as your man says, build once, sell twice, right?
And Jack like, Butcher, exactly.
That kind of thinking, okay, cool, now we've got one song, okay, like how do we take more people's money? Let's put four songs on the same record, great, you can take 10 quid off them. All right, now we've got like, say like 20 years later, we've got CDs, fine, we can take 20 pound off them now. That is, and it just kept on going, and then I guess now it's kind of gone backwards. It's like, oh, we can get the maximum utility out of one song, or you know, 90 seconds of someone's time. Central C is gone, all right, 90 seconds is all I've got, that's all I'm going to give. You know what I'm saying? And people always adapted their art to the forms of what is going on. Same with pirate radio, like, you know, I used to buy records and the songs would be eight minutes long and shit. Now no one does that because the DJs have got CDJs, like these things that you can play the music so fast, there's no reason to have extended mix, you know, 10 minute house songs anymore.
It's people's attention span has gone down as well, right? So like eight minutes for a song, unless you're like on a plane or like at home or what, or like listen to a proper headphones and you really want to take it in, like most people are just going to hear like that Tim Westwood drop, like the way he would always switch it every like 30 seconds. He's cancelled as well. Yeah. Probably writing some on that one. He did some wild stuff. The other example is like Drake. I'm pretty sure, again, without knowing the details, I know a lot of people called one of his recent albums like just a streaming album. It was like, you know, like shorter songs. And like, I don't actually know in this recent album, but like a couple of years ago, I remember people talking about that. It was like made for the stream. And
yeah, the playlist, More Life album. Yeah.
Exactly. And so like, that's another thing. It's like the kind of principle there is about like incentives, right? Like whatever you design the system for, the incentive, like whatever the incentive is, people are going to go towards that. So,
And that's exciting. It's not like I don't think it's just
a negative thing.
With all these artists, I'm like, you can do what you want. It's like, it's fine. I'm not saying don't make the album or don't make the EP or don't make the 8-minute song. I'm just like, be mindful of it though. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you can, there's some fun playing this on hard mode and there's some fun playing on easy. There's somewhere in between. And like, some people just don't know. They just think you have to do it that way for to get through. And you know that there's that tweet, man, that is like, something doesn't own this and something doesn't own that. This is the new economy. There's like
tweet. It's like a tweet template, like people use it. Yeah.
And I did the thing in my thread yesterday.
It's like Uber. Sorry, just to clarify for people who haven't seen it, I think it's something along the lines of like Uber doesn't own any cars, Airbnb doesn't own any homes, and then there's like a punchline after that.
Yeah, this is the new economy. And for artists, I think, you know, the artist doesn't have to have an album. The journalist doesn't have to have articles. The, you know, the director doesn't have to have movies to be, you know, those things anymore. Like, you can be a journalist and only operate on YouTube. You can be an artist and not work in these traditional formats. You can just do singles, or you can, again, you could be just making songs for TikTok and just banging them out and having fun with it. You could just be a DJ. Like, you could be a DJ and not do radio or like operate.
You could just be curating a playlist on Spotify and probably get more like traction nowadays.
Exactly. It wouldn't take away you being a DJ. It'd just be something, a different way of presenting things. And I try and like push that to people. It's like journalism, for example, isn't the medium. Like, journalism is like that, the work and what you're doing, what you're putting together, the information that you're giving people. The filter could be anything. Like, the canvas could be anything. And that's what I'm trying to do with my, you know, this project, the Yellow Squares project, is like, it's, that is music journalism, but it's not articles. It's not on a Resident Advisor. It's not on The Guardian or something. Like, it doesn't.
Yeah, it's where people are spending their time now. Right, exactly. In fact, even more so the case. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's so a great way to put it.
I want it to get read. I want it to get engaged with. I want people to disagree as well, like, and question like what they're doing and go, actually, like sometimes I'm 35, 18-year-old says, uncle, like, you're trying shit.
uncle. Like,
cool. And I'm like, yeah, cool. You do it your way. And they do something mind blowing to me. And I'm like, oh shit. Like, I would just never got something out of that. And I'm gassed. I'm a fan. I'm just like, okay, sick. You know, like, when you see these people, I'm just like, yeah, like, that's why I love music. That's why I love DIY culture. That's why I love Twitter, even, when people come up crazy tweets, or TikToks, when people come out with most insane stuff. It's like,
yeah,
that's why I'm on the internet.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bambi. If you're running a business, you know your employees can create all kinds of interesting situations for you, both good and bad. You've been there. Somebody isn't showing up on time when they're supposed to, attracting and retaining top talent, figuring out how to navigate remote work situations. That's why you need to talk to Bambi. With Bambi, you get access to your own dedicated HR manager starting at just $99 per month. They're available by phone, email, and real-time chat, so onboarding and terminations can run smoothly, team members reach peak performance, and your business stays compliant with changing HR regulations. And with Bambi's HR autopilot, you're automating important HR practices like setting policies, training, and feedback. Bambi is dedicated HR managers. That's a US-based person dedicated to your business, giving you access to the HR expertise and personal touch you need. HR managers can easily cost $80,000 a year, but Bambi starts at just $99 per month. Schedule your free conversation today so you can see how much Bambi can take off your plate. Go to Bambi.com right now and type in Creator Lab under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show, and that is spelled Bambee.com. That's Bambi.com, and type in Creator Lab. That's what that's what we all loved about in the first place. And that's the reason I brought it up. I can't remember, I wrote a tweet about this after reading Dan Hancock's book that you were quoted in it as well, I think. And that book, like we mentioned it earlier, I'd highly recommend it if you're interested in this sort of stuff. It's like a really beautifully, like, it's a beautiful story, because he basically takes like elements of music and he's basically telling the history of London and the UK in recent times, maybe not like ancient history, but in the last like 50 years or more, he's kind of talking about politics and immigration and gentrification in different areas and like all that sort of stuff. And one of the things I kept thinking about was just like, especially last year when Web3 was the buzzword, now it's kind of almost like a laughable word, like people are like making fun of it because like the number went down, and that's the funny thing basically. But we were exploring like actually like cool ideas. Like one of the ideas I remember, I actually went to an event last week and met a guy who worked with it. Who was it? Not Mariah Carey, like a really old school like singer who's like super famous, and they essentially created an NFT for her one like unreleased song, and they sold it for like $1 million or something like that, and they turned it into an NFT. And then there's Royal, which is another platform, which essentially is like working, I think they work with Nas, they work with a few different DJs and stuff.
And Snoop and stuff, yeah.
Exactly. So. And they're trying to say, like, how can we use the new stuff to, you know, like, create a fun, unique experience for fans, slash maybe there's a bit more. Maybe you get a part ownership in this song. And when you're talking about that, those streams, revenue you get from streams, if I was like an early, you know, fan, and instead of me just buying the t-shirt at the end of the concert for £20, if I put £20 into buying that song, that now in the future you've blown up, I get to kind of like share in your success essentially. And I get, you know, there's a whole like debate there, like should people be speculating on stuff like this? But my take always is like, let the market decide. Like if people like it enough, if the idea is cool enough and it catches on, that is how new stuff emerges. And once upon a time, MP3 sounded stupid and LimeWire sounded stupid. And a lot of people don't know, but Spotify came out of like that world too. Like Daniel Ek, the founder, basically worked in like torrent stuff back in the day, from my understanding. So like that technology originally came from something illegal, and now is something where there's a guy that lives right near me. He's probably like 92 years old, and I walk down the street every day, and he's outside all day playing from Spotify on his big boombox. Just having the time of his life, and it cost him $10. A month, right, or whatever you got. And that to me is like, a lot of people who don't come from technology might not know this phrase, but you talk about, you know, we're talking about inflation right now, like how prices of everything's gone up. Technology is actually deflationary. It's one of the things that brings down the cost of things, because to get access to that music before would have cost thousands and thousands of pounds or dollars. Now it costs $10 in your pocket. And again, without going into all the ethical stuff and if that is right or wrong, like the truth is, we all like paying $10 and getting unlimited music. So that is kind of what happens. So I think a lot of people...
And you operate around it, right? Like you operate around that like constraint. And like, it just made me think that, imagine if we still operated under the old system and the pandemic happened, like you couldn't get any new music because supply chain has just completely stopped off records and CDs. We'd had no new music for like 18 months.
No, it would have been terrible. Yeah, we needed the music, especially in that time. I mean, all jokes aside, like podcasts, YouTube and music, and obviously my relationships, like that is what gets you through those bad times, man. Like we would have been absolutely messed up without music in that time. So we've talked a little bit about like what has happened in the past, what's kind of happening now. I like that one post. We'll come back to a few of yours in a second. But let's talk about like looking forward. Are there other things that you're seeing? Like you said, the 18-year-old doing something differently and your mind is blown. And I know you follow kind of like this space a little bit as well, like the NFT stuff we talked about a little bit earlier. Is there anything you're looking at and saying, oh, like it's hard to predict, but that could be something in the future that would be cool for artists to have?
I guess like everyone, but a lot of people are so multidisciplinary that before, yeah, we're talking about a rapper or a producer or a DJ or something. But a lot of the kids that are coming through now can DJ, they can rap, they can make the beat, they can shoot the video, they own their own channels and like have like some basic semblance of business. Like, so they're like a super human artist, one package, one person. And what I'm trying to promote is like, don't give away any of that. Keep that and develop that and find people that you can plug into and work with to maintain that as strong as possible. Like a lot of our generation was like, oh yeah, don't be a jack of all trades, master of none. It's like,
yeah,
these lot are like pick masters of six or seven things, like,
yeah. Well, and they're good masters, at it,
but you know what I mean, they're good,
but they're really good. They're like 80% away there. Like I call it like it's a very tech word, but like full stack creator. You're like you have to learn. Like I taught myself to do Final Cut Pro, even though I outsource it now and pay for it, but like me knowing about the ins and outs of the audio and how to get rid of background noise and leveling and all that stuff means when I pay someone to do it, I know my stuff and the much better and the craft of it. Like, I also like the craft of like creating stuff, so I think it's worth it. But so that's interesting. I think especially like promoting stuff, right? Like if you think of Central C, we talked about before, right? Like him or someone on his team thought about that first line in the song, right?
Yeah, it'll be him. There's no marketing manager that could come up with that. There's no like PR, social media manager, like all these things. I'm just like, that is what you're looking for. Like that coming from the artist, their brain on the TikTok, you know, money printer, bang, bang, bang. Like, it's like, I find that fascinating.
And that's a good one.
Yeah, it's a good one. He's got like one of the maddest first lines in a song this year, I think. So
So I was saying, yeah, that too, but I was saying like the idea, what you're saying of like the full stat, like the multidisciplinary artist.
Yeah. You know what it does as well that people are not clocking is that our incomes, again, like I said, it was 90% shows or something. These lot, because their skills are a bit more broad, they might have a day
more
job.
More diverse.
Film editing, they can make their songs and it takes the pressure off having to make money off the song. They can be more a bit more true to their vision and take a bit more time. Like they're earning like earn decent money in like say if they work for Google or something and they're doing that on the side, and then the skill that no one has yet worked out how to monetize, they're already 5 steps ahead of everyone. So there's going to be like people that kind of converge on, oh, I'm a film editor, I'm a songwriter, and I understand, I don't know, Ethereum, and then it just goes boom, like because they know that more than anyone else. Like,
All right, that's interesting. All right, so I like that idea of multidisciplinary. I'm obviously a big fan of that. Though I will say I think it's important for people to realize like you can't do everything. Also, like you have to like manage your resources, and like the way my filter for it is always like the stuff that gives you most energy and the stuff that drains your energy. Like you might need to do it in the beginning, but that's for me, like the editing part eventually just becomes so tiring. It's just like, it can take 8 hours to editing like 1-2 hour episode, right? So it's better just
it's
to
like
pay someone who's really good at it.
You can get let go of it, right?
Exactly. And then you just mentioned Ethereum there. So let's talk a little bit about that. I know we're both into this world. You're kind of following this world a little bit. And so like, what is interesting? Are there any examples that you're seeing of people using this new, you know, Web3, crypto-y, NFT stuff in an actual way that is beneficial? Because back to my earlier point, I think a lot of people who are now like into this music, if they're 35 years old and they just hear that word and they're at their day job and they just heard about someone flipping a monkey JPEG for $1 million, they like see it in a very negative light. Or they read a Guardian headline about energy consumption for Bitcoin and that they just buck it all in. So like, I'm curious if anything is standing out to you, like anyone's doing this in an interesting way.
How I became interested in it is I thought about you don't set the price of music. Like it's one of the few businesses that you can't set the price in, can't set the price of like tickets are kind of harder to do that in as well. Like this is a thing where there's a culture accepted that an artist can set the price for their work that they want and someone can pay that. And there's like agreements built within that. And I think that's kind of cool on that's it alone. Even if there was no crypto, there's no technology, that just that idea alone was exciting enough for me to be like, oh, this is worth paying attention to. Then I started like, you know, listening to Vitalik and all these people talk about that stuff. And to be honest, like a lot of it, now I understand it more. Does it excite me more? It's more the, okay, I want to sell my work for £100, $100, and someone's comfortable paying that, I'll give them a mechanism to do that seamlessly with very few like middlemen or interactions. That's sick alone. Like that's my basis for
it's taking that, interest in the visual space. We showed before, community direct, basically.
Exactly. Like people think it's crazy to pay money for music, period. And now people go, okay, well, I want to pay money for your 3D artwork that you've clearly put a lot of time and energy and effort into. Like, yeah, maybe I can sell it on in the future, maybe not. But you've created something awesome. I want to like support you and continue. So like that just patronage kind of thing into like, yeah. Especially people that got money already. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think the other thing I'd point to is like, if you compare selling a Basquiat painting or something like that to buying a poster of Basquiat like on a site, or honestly just a CD of a musician, like in like the reason a Basquiat painting is worth so much more is because it's rare, and it's because there's only a few of them, right? And like and the types of people who are buying it are, they're buying it because they want to hang it up in their rich house, right? But they're also buying it because it's an investment. And I think to a lot of creative people, the word investment, they just get turned off by, because it's just like a very pure, I'm talking a traditional, stereotypical creative person. Obviously, both you and I are creative people who like this stuff as well. But just to, and that like purity, and like, I want to just do the craft. I just want to make the music. I just want to write the book. But all the other stuff, they're realizing the world is moving on, and they just kind of shut it off. And I'm sensing that a lot of the time when I speak to a lot of people that are pure musicians or pure, you know, like I've spoken to someone recently who was writing, I mean, I'll just say my cousin who wrote a book and published a book, right? Also grew up in that area, has a published book like with a major, you know, I think it's like HarperCollins or whatever, major publisher. And he's like, yeah, look, man, I just want to write, and like all this Instagram stuff and Twitter stuff, like I just don't really want to do it. And I get it, right? Because I'm also simultaneously trying to use my phone less and be on social media less. But like, it's one of those things where I was saying to him, man, like, I get it, but also like that is the world. It's like, that is how people consume things. And that's how, when you go into a publisher, like they're looking at your social followers, and you can think that's annoying because you associate followers with an influencer taking a selfie. But you could also see it as, oh, well, they put some value in the world, and whether that value is just looking good, or like what you guys, you're doing, or what Jack's doing, like with sharing ideas, like 20,000 people follow you on Instagram and your face isn't even shown there, right? They're not just following you because you look good. It's because you're putting out value to the world. And I think that's kind of, I think something we should encourage more people who are creative to do more of, because it's only moving more in that direction, and if you don't, you're kind of going to be left behind.
I think everyone's just got to find a way that works for them. Like, I think people talk about hating social media, and I'm like, you hate what you think social media is.
Oh, that's a great point.
Right, it's like saying you hate television or you hate radio or something. Mm. It's just a medium. Like, it has no feelings. Or hate music. Yeah,
well, I hate pop music. No, and it's like, all right, well then go find the other thing you do like.
Yeah, and if you're creating stuff for mass, like if you're releasing with a publisher or something, like you want it to go well too. Like you want to have the second book or the third book. So just learning like ways to feel comfortable with it. It's just so you can actually continue making work that you enjoy.
Yeah, completely.
You take it to that basic level. But you might make different work as well. Like this project, you know, a lot of people hit me up and like, oh, you should do a book. I'm like, I'm not done.
This is the book. So can we go into that more? Because I think that's a great point. First of all, you got 20,000 people following you, and that spreads to more than 20,000 people on it. Twitter, I don't know your numbers on there, but you just had a super viral thread, infrastructural challenges and electronic music. We can go into that in a second. It's got like, you know, a few hundred retweets, 1,000 likes. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but if you go to like view activity or like impressions and stuff, you can see how many people it reached. And just to think like that reached probably more than 90% of books. And I'm not saying it's a book, obviously, like a book is 8-10 hours worth of like deep writing and edited and everything. But this is also like well edited. Like this took you ages to write, I'm sure, in a way, or it took you some time to write and to like spit out. And I think that's another thing. Like, I think a lot of people mix up like this old idea of what they've had of like, I've got a bucket list thing of writing a book, which is nothing wrong with that. Like, I would like to maybe write a book one day, but that is just like an old way of seeing it versus what is a book? A book is sharing my ideas or sharing a story. Okay, now we've taken that away from it being a physical book or a Kindle book. Now you say like, well, where is people actually spending their time? And it is on social media. It's on Twitter. It's on Instagram. So I'm curious that when you started that Yellow Squares project, like what was the kind of like plan here? Was there like a big grand plan, or was it more like, tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah, there was no plan. There is no plan. It's just sharing what I've learned. So that thread took as long as it took to type out, but it's my experience of working in this space for that 10 years, you know? So I didn't, and there was no pre-written. It was, I was on the train to Manchester and just, I did one by one by one by one, because those are things I'm experiencing day to day. So it was easy to write. And the yellow squares are just generally like what I'm experiencing in music. They're not really that abstract. Just like, oh, actually the thing's gone up 20%. We probably should charge more. Oh, we shouldn't charge more. Oh shit, I'm going to lose a bit of money now. Like, you know what I mean? I'm just saying what I see.
Trying to
break it down for people. And maybe, you know, I thought like just during the pandemic, I'm like, what am I actually on social media for? Like, what do I get the most out of? Like, is it, yeah, obviously memes, jokes, whatever. But so much of it was, especially for DJ culture and stuff, it was like, oh, like this person's on a beach. This person's like drinking an Aperol Spritz. It's like, all right, cool, whatever. Like, no one is interested in me at that level to just put stuff like that there. So I've got to be useful to the community that I'm part of. And it's like, all right, cool. Like, maybe just distill everything I've learned and I'll probably learn something back from that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I love that.
But there isn't like a grand plan. Just every time, basically every time I put something out, it gives me another idea and I'm like, okay, maybe it's that. Okay, why don't we put a live show? Or why don't we do this? Like, and why don't we do a poster? And it's just as I go. It's a live project. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Love that. And so you mentioned the word constraints earlier. I want to come back to that idea. So you've got a yellow canvas with black writing. Similar, we've talked about, like, with Jack, Mutual Connection as well. He does black canvas white and he does his illustrations in a similar way, different way, however you want to say it. So I remember talking to him about it and he's like, just when you create that constraint creatively, it just allows you to create more frequently. You're not overthinking it. The same reason both you and I wear black t-shirts is because I saw you post that. I was cracking up as well because I have like 25 black t-shirts in there as well. I'm trying to mix it up nowadays, but throw in a gray one once in a while, keep people on the toes. But yeah, so it's the same thing. So I'm curious, like, yeah, was that something conscious as well for you to like have a consistent like brand there as well? Was it more for yourself?
So the branding thing came from the label. So like the label partners that I ran was black and yellow design, like, or the branding was black and yellow. So it came from us pressing a record. So the printers would be like, it was four colors to print. It was like 700 quid, but two colors was 500 and I only had 500 quid.
So oh, I was like, that's hilarious.
Black and yellow. So I always just used that as like my motif in all of our work. So when I started doing this, it was just, that was what it was going to be. It was going to, and then people were like, oh, is it supposed to be a post-it note? I was like, oh yeah, post-it notes are black and yellow.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I didn't even think of that.
Again, didn't even think of that when I was just did it. I just did it because that was my like brand colors. And then, when I just drew the smile one day, I was like, oh shit, the rave smile is black and yellow. I was like, this is like, it's too easy. Things just writes itself. And then, I'll just have like yellow things. Like,
got it.
Yeah, be like little,
you're on brand today, man.
I can just have,
yellow, just orange have, like, juice with a black tea. All right. So, but beyond the colors though, like that idea of like constraints, like, could you, mm-hmm. is that something that is helping you as well?
Okay, because,
like,
well, I'm not a designer.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah,
not a designer.
It.
So the more I introduce, the more complicated I make it for myself. So I'm not like Jack where he studied design and all this stuff. Like, this is basic AF because I don't know how to use this stuff. Like, I got an iPad last year.
Oh yeah.
And just been figuring out, my dexterity is really poor. And I'm just scribbling the ideas. I found a little way to make some things easier for myself, but I'm not a designer. These are just the scribbles, the ideas. Then it's like a napkin, you know, like what people say.
No, I love
math.
It. I think it actually looks, even without being a designer, I think that's kind of what's intriguing about it, because it feels like, oh, you're sharing it. The post-it, now I see it completely, because you've got like a little image in the corner sometimes, but sometimes it's just like words, like it's bare hot. Bear Hot Fam was one of my favorites as well, which is good. which means it's very hot for people who don't know what that slang means. But yeah, I think it actually looks quite cool to me. Like, I think that's the scribbles. You're kind of inspiring me. I feel like I need to do this. I've been saying for a while, people listen on the pod, I've got an old Arsenal website that I ran for ages, and I've had it for ages that I've kind of wanted to do something with. And I need to do something that makes it easy for myself. And doing something like what you guys are doing it just seems like something so obvious that I should be just doing to work that muscle a bit more.
Yeah, it's healthy, man. It's healthy. And just every time I post something, just the confidence builds. So like when I was posting the first ones, like they weren't so good or whatever, or just maybe I'll figure out words that trigger emotions for people, and then I'll play around with them or like switch. Like, so a lot of it is like the use of words, like arrangement of things, maybe more than the actual design. Like the, you know, like, I guess the comparison of like visualized value is like his is more drawn and, you know, well put together. Like they're really beautiful images, whereas these are like word plays and things that I know that are going to like kind of not bug people, but make them react for
create
the wrong
conversation.
Reason. Like, yeah, exactly.
That makes sense. All right, I'm going to share one more of your things here. So you said if you're spending 20K for a degree, and I'll say 200K if you're in America, for a lot of people, like 100K. Like for an MBA, it's like 200. For an average person in the US, it might be like 20, 30 a year, probably more than that. I don't actually know the numbers, but let's say it could be six figures, basically, like, right, 50 to 100K. In debt, a lot of people get in from degrees, basically. Then, so you said if you're spending 20K for a degree, they should let you spend 1K on a project you release. I think this is amazing. I think this is like right down my alley. So let's talk about it. Would you want to expand on that idea? I mean, are you saying like you should be able to take a loan, essentially, like the way we take a student loan for 20K?
Yeah, like a student loan. Like part of the allocation should be for you to try a thing, make the thing, or whatever it's going to be. Like, and a lot of my friends, like they'll go and do a master's or PhD or some shit like that. Yeah, and then they write a whole 20,000 word thing, and then it goes and sits on some shelf of some person that's marking it, and no one ever reads it. I'm like, what?
Yeah,
like can we put it out? Can we make an Instagram? Can we do something? Like you've done all this work. You want people to see it, and a lot of the like I get asked to contribute to people's dissertations and stuff. I'm like, this is not a dissertation. This is a business. This is a business idea or business plan. Like, dude, this is what you have to do when you finish this course of study. But they don't have the resources. Most of the people just be like, oh, fuck, I'm broke now. I need to go and get a job.
Yeah, like, yeah. Like that. I feel the same way with education as well. Because did you go to uni as well after? Or?
Yeah, yeah, I went to uni. I did a business degree like an idiot.
All right, yeah, similar, but yeah, and what did you do before that at Monex when we were there? Was it similar?
I did economics, ICT, and business.
Man, we were pretty. Yeah, I did economics.
Oh, hold computing. On! I have to ask this. Did you have Barry Reeves?
Barry Reeves. I was just about to say. Okay, this is amazing. Because when you said economics, I was about to ask. So, for people who don't know, Barry Reeves is the reason that like I went into that and did economics. And honestly, like if you ever see me draw a graph in my head the way you just did earlier and you were describing something, it comes from the 2 years I did A levels with Barry Reeves. He's just is he still around? Do you know if he's still teaching?
I'm not too sure.
But, oh man, we should send this to him. This would be cool. But yeah, it's a question I ask a lot of people is like, who's the best teacher you ever had? And who's the worst teacher you ever had, and just compare them. And I'll just say it straight up, the computing guy that I had in the same school was my worst teacher, because he like just really didn't like me, and he was like discouraged me quite a lot. Even though I ended up doing a lot of stuff with computers, I didn't end up really like programming much, because that was what you're supposed to be doing. I was so put off. But with economics, the teacher he would tell stories about saving someone from a fire and then talk about macroeconomics somehow, and it would just stick. So that's cool, man. You did like business and stuff as well. So that's kind of how I can see that translating into what you're doing now.
And even like Web3 and stuff, all the terminology was just like, oh, this is easy. Like this is not something that was completely alien to. I think a lot of people look at that space and they're like, oh, you know, the number go up type thing. And it's like, that becomes like quite intimidating.
Naturally to you.
Yeah.
No, I completely get it.
At least one level familiar. If you understood like stocks and stuff a bit, then you're already halfway there.
You can understand. Yeah, for sure, man. And then we're going to talk about this statement you said in a second about Rinse FM. So we'll come to that in a second. But before we do that, I do want to bring up the close the app, make the thing again. yeah. Let's bring this up. So this was actually from your recent event. And for people watching on YouTube, you can see this close the app, make the thing. You got a mic. And by the way, I want to call out that your correct mic technique, that's how I know you're a music guy, because even when you're holding it now, I could see you know what you're doing with that mic. I appreciate that. Yeah, so it's looked like a really cool thing. This is DEE, right?
Yeah.
So DEE, legend in UK music as well, came and did a little performance. Looked like some emotional scenes here. So yeah, really cool. I mean, this is amazing, man. Look, you two embracing on stage. So tell me a little bit about, one, this idea, and two, like this Yellow Squares thing coming into real life. Like you did a live event. What happened there, man?
I've been talking to a lot of people on the internet for the last couple of years with this project, or last year with this project, and I've been putting on events for so long as well. But it was like the meshing of those two worlds. So like people that knew me from DJ culture and grime and all this stuff, and then the people that only know me through the Yellow Squares. So I was like, okay, let's bring everyone together. And I'll talk about the writing and the project and what next in real life. Because obviously all this internet stuff is cool, but you want to like see people and like feel something. So I kind of did it in a format of like a lecture, like kind of TED Talk style thing, had some massive screen behind me so I could blow up the Instagrams to like bigger than life size, like double my size or more than double my size, which is pretty cool. Just the visual of it, I thought people would share. Once, you know, they're taking pictures and sharing it, kind of made it more potent. And then, the DEE is like a legendary grime MC. And 3 years ago, I did a tweet saying, oh, whenever I'm at jazz or hip hop or house events techno events, I always think, oh, DEE will just make this 10,000 times better.
That's a great point.
And then I put this tweet on the screen and then I said, you know, like Steve Jobs had this line, one more thing at the end of
iPhone, yeah.
And then I was like, all right, at the end of the talk, I was like, all right, one more thing. And just said that tweet and then people just laughed and didn't think anything of it. I played like one of his songs, Street Fighter Rhythm, and people were like, okay, what's going on? And then he came out and once they heard his voice in the mic, the room just lifted. It was like, oh my God. Like,
yeah, something that only live music can do, right? Like
exactly.
That
so just bridging the two things of like, you know, the information, the live, and it's just been fun as well. Like sometimes I'm listening to like, you know, like your guys like Sailor and I'm like, is Sailor having a nice time? Like sometimes I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, he doesn't laugh a lot.
He might be having too nice a time. That might be the problem, you know what I mean?
I mean, he's having too nice a time
buying $1 billion worth of Bitcoin and doing crazy stuff. No, I get what you're saying. Well, that's awesome, man. I mean, how many people came to that?
This is 400 people.
Damn, that's a lot of people for your first like live event for this project. I know you've put on events before. And did you send an email out to your email list and stuff from before as well?
No. So I just made this from scratch. Like, so this, the email list for this event was just done.
Oh, sick.
Like last month, August. Yeah.
To get 400 people to come in person to anything is a lot, man. That's not easy to do. Do you think you're going to do more of those?
Yeah. So how I'll do it in the future is I'll do it in collaboration with artists. So say if I can, I don't know, work with, I don't know, like whatever the dream list is, Jordan Peele or something, and he does a bunch of Yellow Squares, and then we talk through it like back to back, like a live podcast, effectively, but on our feet, so it's not like two dudes sitting down talking. Not that I've got anything against that. But,
yeah. Okay.
Like, what are we doing
right now? No, I'm joking.
I always make jokes about the DJ's black t-shirts and this kind of shit. But anyway. Something like that where it's quite interactive and people can ask questions and then again it being put back on the internet, so I put it on YouTube so people can kind of watch it back as well. So just so it's like a different interview format and something bridging the internet, real life, back and forth. And then the close that make the thing was like a DM response to someone one day. They were like asking for some creative advice or something. I was like, just close that, make the thing. You need to come off this app.
Like, get off this. Stop. Yeah.
Yeah. Touch some grass. Do all the, just get out, get off this thing. This is not helping you. I can't help you. there's nothing here. And then actually when I said it and at the event, and a bunch of people saying it with me, I was like, oh, this is the slogan. This is like the...
No, I love it. Yeah.
The thing. And then...
It organically came up though, because it came through the conversation. I know exactly.
Yeah.
And it's that when that hits, you're like, oh, I didn't even think of this, but it just came up.
Exactly. And then like, yeah, even like the ting is like a Jamaican kind of twang on it. And like people in London, everyone in London has a bit of Jamaican in their way they speak.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I even said it before, and I'm not Jamaican, but it's even like in football, like for ages when we were trying to get like Theo Walcott to sign a contract or someone else, everyone's like, sign the thing. And it's like people from America and like Europe saying, sign the thing. And so it's like the most London thing. Obviously it comes from like Jamaica as well, but I'm saying like for me as a Londoner, that's where it comes from.
And then now, like the day after that, I did this thing called the Doom Scroll Formula, which is you actually have to put it on the screen.
Should we bring it up? Let me bring it up because it's a little formula. Give me 1 second. But yeah, why don't you just share like roughly like what the idea is?
I guess the point of it is like
why you
the amount
want
of time
to
we spend on our screens and like how much time we've actually got to do creative projects. I haven't got time. And then when they see how much time they spend on their phone looking at Instagram, like, well, what if you used half of that time even just to work on the creative thing, just what you can do. I'm not talking about, you know, making a blockbuster movie here. I'm just talking about the basics of like writing your ideas down, or, you know, even just calling your friend back or going for a beer and just starting that thing.
Just get up. So I'm trying to find it here. If you're
right at the top, it's right at the top.
Oh,
so that one in the
this
middle.
One here, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So this is really good. I did it after, and I was horrified too. So I mean, the thing is, I will say for me, it's like half of my work is also kind of on social platforms as well, and I kind of have it's a bit of a weird, like for Twitter, for example. Like I don't actually write that much on Twitter anymore. I was for a little while, but obviously I put a podcast, we promote stuff, and then annoyingly me, Jack and Trung have a group chat within DMs on Twitter, and I've tried to move it to WhatsApp, and we do put it on WhatsApp sometimes, but like half the time we're sharing stuff for the podcast on Twitter, so it's like, oh man, it's a bit of a struggle. All right, so let's go through the Doom Scrum formula. Number one, I'll let you say it, actually. Go.
Okay, so number one is look at your weekly screen time. Then two is multiply this by 52 to get what a year looks like if you stayed at the average. Then minus your age versus 80, which is the average life expectancy.
Oh,
then
boy.
You multiply steps 2 and 3. So you would have like a total of amount of hours. So the highest I've heard so far was 17 years of lifetime.
Oh, God. That's
screen.
Wild. That's
I
wild.
I guess like if they're like 25, that is that bad? Maybe. I don't know. But
maybe
what I should have
done
is social media alone, I think, because of so much people do work on this. Yeah,
that's what I was. I know. I think it comes back to something you said earlier, Elijah. Is like, you said something about like what is social media to you, like whatever you make it. So, for example, when I'm reading stuff on Twitter, though, actually, I don't find Twitter as fun as I did like a year ago, because there's a lot of these like annoying threads. Like, there are 8 billion people breathing oxygen, and you're not breathing correctly. Like that sort of stuff. Like just clickbait, essentially. But for like a lot of the time, I'm like on there reading like stuff the way you just wrote that other thread, or like a bunch of people sharing really good stuff. And so it's like reading about like interesting information is not necessarily bad. It's bad when you're just scrolling without any control, and you're just in that dopamine cycle, basically. You're just going back in, you press open the app instinctively, and then you see, like, honestly, Instagram is generally for me a little bit like less value for me personally.
Definitely.
But again, it's like depends who you're following. If I'm following you and I'm following other people actually sharing cool stuff, then it can be positive. But yeah, definitely. I mean, the other thing is if you're complaining and you're saying I don't have time, which is kind of the point here, right? Like people say, oh, I don't have time, but you might actually be able to carve out some time. So that's the slogan. I think
reading that stuff as well without action, that's the thing. It's like you're not just say, like, if you're reading it on Twitter, but you bring it up on NIA, or you like look for people to interview for this, or connect with people. Like, I think a lot of people are using it passively. Like they're taking it like television, like they're
just entertainment.
Yeah. Or just like getting so involved in other people's lives and the way they're doing things that you don't think you can do it yourself, or you don't know what the mechanism for you to have a point of view and put it out there. You know what I mean? So most of my friends that are super smart don't share stuff, but think other people that do are dumb.
Yeah, that's
like, oh, this person's an idiot. Like, they don't know anything about that thing. I'm like, well, why don't you?
Why don't you share? You know more. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah.
And it's super inspiring when I see like people break out of, you know, their own, you know, comfort. Like, I'm not like a introvert by any means, but I'm not also not extrovert. And there's some people that I've seen, you know, that were a bit more introverted that have found their topic. If they like whatever, yeah, say like Web3 or something, or gaming or something, they can talk about that and do it well and just stay in that lane. And that's made them a more confident person in many situations when they know what they're talking about. Sick to see.
That is sick, man. Yeah. And last thing on that, before we close out, I'm going to bring up some, we're not finishing yet, but there's a last section we'll go into in a second. Like, I've asked this to a few people recently. I just had Trung, obviously Trung does the NIA pod with me, but I actually just had him on Creator Lab in the last episode. And he, you know, he writes so much, like he takes in crazy information. He writes every day. He's a writer, for people who don't know. And so, and there's been a few other people I've asked this recently too. Like, you seem like someone who's interested in many different things, even though obviously like music and technology and business might be that kind of like, you know, personal monopoly, we call it in this world. Like, is that something consciously you've like thought about to say like, these are things I'm going to write about and not write about? And like share on this one, you know, Instagram page versus, oh, I need to create a new one for this other lane. Like, for example, if I like talking about Arsenal, I'm not going to tweet about it on Beads AD Twitter because it's like most of the people there don't know what Arsenal is or care about it. So I have another one, Arsenal Review, which is like my lane for that, which once in a while you'll see me during the game getting excited. So I'm curious that how you think about that, because it's honestly, it's something I actually kind of struggle with as someone who's interested in many things. To like, you don't want to limit yourself, but also you want to create deeper resonance with the people who care about that stuff. So I'm curious how you think about that.
I think if you're covering something regularly, like, and it's got that particular space, like the Arsenal thing, then it is good to have a separate space for that. But for me, like, yeah, my core work is in music and technology, I guess. So I'm going to write about that the most.
Yeah.
But then I can't discount like my experiences of going to other shows or football or going to Jamaica or going like, or watching Lex Friedman podcast. Like I'll put that in just so like, you know, one every 10 tweets. So people know where it's coming from. It's not random. Or sometimes what happens is people think I don't know what I'm talking about with certain topics because I don't cover it in my Twitter.
Got it.
So if I don't put, I don't know, something about, what's a good example of this? I don't know, like space. Something.
Yeah.
I know a little bit.
Yeah.
Enough to hold a conversation. But then if they've only heard me talk about grime, then like, you don't know nothing about that. I'm like, well, maybe that's what I've been reading about the last couple of years. Or like all these Balaji threads of the network state and stuff. I feel smarter after I read that shit.
So I'm like, okay,
I'm going to share a point of view or share like that, but it's not going to become like dominant in what I'm saying, because it's not a space I'm working in or actively thinking about. Like I do this with like pro wrestling. Sometimes I'll like, because I watch wrestling, I'm like, no one wants to see that shit on my timeline.
But occasionally,
when something maybe I think is like particularly funny or bleeds over or is like, gives me
Logan pulls on it and you're like, oh, that's kind of in this world. Like I did that recently, though I don't watch wrestling anymore, but I get what you're saying. Like,
yeah,
it just
Logan Paul is like fascinating. Obviously people think he's an asshole, but like, he's boxing, he's doing pro wrestling, he's releasing loads of product,
crazy.
He's doing the YouTube podcast thing. And like, people don't want to hear that, but I'm like, yo, that's what, on a smaller scale, we can do as artists now. Like the artist career is going to be a lot more interesting. Like, do we need, how many Nas albums do you need? Like, you don't need 20. Like you need 4, 5 maybe, and you can listen to the rest of your life. Awesome. But so with these artists now, I'm like, don't need to probably make 5 albums. You might only need to make 3 or here and there or whenever you feel like it. But the in-between bits become just as exciting when you follow an artist. Like what I see Skepta doing now, I'm like, oh, he dropped a painting with Sotheby's. He's doing a collab with Puma and he dropped the clothes from the painting with this other designer and he's DJing at like techno at DC 10. I'm like, okay, it's it's not just that he's doing loads of stuff. He's doing stuff that genuinely interests him.
Yeah.
And is pushing out his artistry and his influence in ways that no one would ever have said, that's what you should do next type yeah. thing. I mean,
well, that was a perfect transition because I was just about to bring up Skepta specifically and a few others because I'm just going to read out the one thing you said to me over our DMs. You said, Rinse FM in the early 10s was like Y Combinator of UK music. I really like that idea. So, and we kind of talked about Rinse FM a little bit earlier, but it was just a radio station, I guess. Is that how you describe it still?
Yeah, so it's a pirate radio station and like the, it was based in East London. It's still there now, actually kind of tomorrow. And a lot of the grime MCs and dubstep as well. So dubstep was like another like massive like cultural phenomenon here in the yeah. UK and in America too.
And that's really that exported was, a lot, yeah.
Yeah, like it was based on Rinse FM. So all of the artists that started dubstep also had shows on this pirate radio station. So this thing was growing alongside grime at the same time. And like all of us all know each other. We're all the same age, kind of like same kind of, yeah, age range. And it, yeah, it took over the world at a different clip compared to grime.
Yeah, I remember going to Fabric, man, back in the day. Fabric in, is it Farringdon?
Yeah,
when that first came out, it was just a crazy type of music. You're like, what the hell is this? You don't even know how to dance to it. Like, it's just a different vibe. You just feel it. So that was, you know, Rinse FM in the early 10s was like the Y Combinator of UK music. For people who are new here, who don't know what Y Combinator is, it's basically the... it's like the Harvard of like startup incubators. So a lot of like famous tech companies have come out of there. Airbnb, but Stripe I think came out of there potentially. There's just a lot of companies that came out of there. But it was this kind of group of talented people with people like Paul Graham and others who ran it. And it was kind of like the value of like bringing lots of similar minded people together and giving them support systems and a network. And just the number of people that came out of that with a success is far greater than basically all the others. So let's talk about some of those. We want to give some shine to some of the people. I think Skepta is a really interesting one just because I'm just going to quickly share my screen again. That one example you just said there. And I know you've probably got a few you want to bring up. But here's Skepta, just signed a creative partnership with Puma after 5 previous sold out Nike collabs. He sold his Sotheby's painting for $82,000. And so, yeah, just like I saw this painting, there was a video they did with it as well. It was really cool where he's kind of explaining what was going on here. But again, like most people think of this guy as like, oh, he's that guy who made that one song that I heard in a rave once upon a time. But he's like an incredibly creative person. But yeah, is there anything else on Skepta before we move on to some of the others?
Yeah, I guess people just miss out that he's a producer. Like he made the beats.
That's not me beat stuff.
Yeah, like I've got the first Skepta. It's his birthday today, actually, when I'm recording this.
Oh, but serious?
The first Skepta record I bought was 19 years ago. So it's not
what
just...
What was that called?
DTI.
DTI, so
that,
okay.
The DTI was the people that used to regulate the FM radio.
Got it.
So it was like a... fuck the DJ.
Yeah. And I remember his first, like, was it his first actual album proper was The Greatest Hits? Was that his first album? Which is also incredible. Like, your first album, you call it Greatest Hits. So good. But yeah, he produced everything on there, I think, right? So really talented. Yeah,
most of his music that he's produced, and he's produced for other people, like he's at Rocky and I guess other grime MCs and stuff. Like, but that I think that bit gets missed out. Most of the rappers, the commercial, like say Jay-Z and Nas, they don't make beats. Like, it's like fascinating that, like I say, that Kanye does, because he's the outlier of those big rappers that actually made beats. Like Drake doesn't make beats. Kendrick Lamar doesn't make beats. All these kind of people. But, you know, Kanye and Skepta, for that scale of artists, for rap, grime, whatever, most of them don't make their own beats. But he is one, and was a DJ back in the day too.
Yeah. I remember on one of my other favorite freestyles of all time is Getz, Kano, and Skepta on like Logan Sama's show. And I remember him saying, I was a DJ. And so they kept going back on some of those old tunes. I've listened to that so many times. All right, let's give some more shout outs to some cool people. People might not have known this one, but this is, I'm just going to share my screen. You shared this with me before. Could you share a bit more about this one?
So is Michaela Cole? Yeah, she went to, she's from like our area as well. She wasn't on rinse though, but yeah, like she had a £1 million Netflix deal for a show, I May Destroy You, and didn't take it, but then went where the BBC retained a percentage of the rights and reportedly earned 3 times that amount, and no doubt has been approached with much better deals since. So I love that kind of pushing back, like not going with the big money. Like everyone would say, that's the bad decision. Take the mill, take the mill, take the mill. It's Netflix. Like,
but yeah,
push back, made something sick. Yeah, she's from Enns as well. Like, say from Enns, like from our same area.
She went to Monarchs as well, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That, so I didn't know that. That's crazy. I mean, you've just mentioned it to me. And I feel like she looks quite familiar, but I don't think I knew her properly, but I'm pretty sure we would have, if she was in my year. That's crazy. And then just another parallel, you guys have probably heard me talk about Andrew Schultz a lot on the show, but Andrew Schultz, a comedian, he did basically exactly the same deal. We don't know the exact numbers, but it was a minimum of $1 million. He sold his comedy special to one of the streamers. I think it was Amazon. They didn't really confirm. It was either Netflix or Amazon. And then they wanted him to change some of the jokes. And he was like, I can't do that. That's not what my art's about. And he took it back. He bought it back from them. And I think it was more than $1 million. And then he sold it directly to people and made 3 times the amount, exact same numbers, which is quite an interesting like parallel, because just they're two very different deals. But to think that both of them made basically 3 times the amount, it just might give you an idea of like when Netflix are doing their numbers, they're estimating, oh, it's going to be this amount of value to us. So yeah, obviously it's different when you're directly selling it to people. But yeah, that's a really cool example. And then you had also shared Jamal Edwards with me as well. RIP Jamal Edwards, a legend in the UK. I'm pretty sure you must have known Jamal. But yeah, so what is there anything you want to share on Jamal?
Yeah, I haven't really been able to talk about him with anyone like publicly, just because there's someone that I knew, but he passed away this year. And yeah, super influential person in UK music. So he started like one of the first big UK YouTube channels. It was just like a super inspirational dude. Just very giving of his time to people. Yeah, super kind. And it's definitely like his work, Virgil as well, Virgil Abloh's work, and their ethos has like influenced the Yellow Squares and the way like, you know, try and take that forward. You know what I'm saying? So the kindness that those two guys have shown a lot of people, me included, like our scene, our people, elders within it especially, like need to continue that. So we've, you know what I mean, it's like a healthy space for people to work in, and yeah, like spreading the, not even spreading the wealth, building the wealth, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think like spreading the wealth is like, there's only one
so
to
much
go around.
You can spread.
Yeah. But it's actually building it and helping people build, and in whatever meaningful way that can be. So the Yellow Squares is sometimes maybe leans towards that. And yeah, just, yeah, I was only recently I felt comfortable That's all good.
I didn't know him. You've probably worked with him and know him very well. If you've kind of grown up in the same scene, I've met him and hung out with him like 2-3 times, and also like would message once in a while. And he was just the most, you know, just like a great energy, man. Like every time you're around him, you just know he's in the room. Like he's like he just like so positive and like fun. I remember actually being at like a YouTube event with him and one other guy called Joel, and like I think he went and requested Temper T, like Temps, what's that song,
Next Hype.
Next Hype. I'm pretty sure he got Next Hype to play at the YouTube event with like all these like execs and stuff, and I'm like, and he was like throwing around stuff, and I'm like, oh my god, this is so funny. He's like the poster child of UK's YouTube at the time, of like, oh, you can be a star. He was in the Chrome advert for us, and he was just being, you know, being himself, which was pretty cool. But
RIP
to him,
that
man.
Was like a massive deal, like to see someone from our scene on the television. Completely. Like he was in a Google advert in the early noughties, and this is at a time when our music wasn't in that space, so like our music wasn't, you know, commercial or in on national television at that time. So it was like between X Factor, so like the biggest program that is on television in the UK, like a talent show, and then seeing like a guy from the grime scene with his camera like shooting and talking about what he does.
Isn't it crazy? Like, yeah, I remember that out because it had what's that song, Tractor or something? Is it?
Yeah, Rex 32. Yeah, Tractor. Yeah,
Rex 32. Because I remember this. I almost like want to play it here, but it's going to get like flagged because of the song and stuff. But you guys can like just go on YouTube and type in Jamal Edwards Google Chrome ad, and the way they cut it with one of my friends actually worked on that campaign, and they were just like the way they cut it with the music, especially as someone who knows the beat, you hear it, you're like, what's this? And then they cut it with the Chrome like stuff and his story. It's like, even when I watch it now, I'm like, yeah, that kind of fires me up. Like, this guy, and I will say two things about that. One is, you just mentioned they're seeing someone that is from our scene, or like, you know, from our background, basically, get on that scale. It makes such a big difference. And I think like 10 years down the road, I've kind of not forgotten it, but I've also just like kind of moved on, because I think like that discussion can become quite like negative to me, like nowadays, because people get very extreme and like just, you know, like forcing stuff in a way. But then I know for sure, like seeing someone like him really inspired me to go like, oh, he's done it, I can go and do something in my own lane, like, you know, in my own creative way. And especially the other thing specifically that I'll just bring up is like the race thing, which I, again, people who know me closely know that I try not to, even I talk about race all the time, because, you know, it's part of life. It's not the first thing I point to when something's going wrong. Like, I won't say it's because I'm Pakistani or because I'm brown, or it's not because of this. Sometimes it is, honestly, right? But like, I try not to jump to that conclusion, because growing up, it kind of was like a bit of a crutch for me. It was like, oh, I grew up thinking it's harder for me than everyone else, which may have been not everyone else, but like a lot of people. And that might have even been true at times. But I found that it didn't stay with me, that kind of attitude, because it felt like I needed to let go of that to just focus on me and focus on myself and not assume that it was because someone didn't like the color of my skin or didn't like where I came from or the way I sounded. Though obviously that definitely happened at times. But I will say, in this case, seeing someone who looks like you as well, and I was talking about like, you know, seeing, I saw Riz Ahmed, that's what I was talking about last week. Saw Riz Ahmed and I'm like, man, this is so sick. And I was actually with a guy called Nikhil who founded Mixcloud. So he kind of knows him.
Okay,
and he was hanging out with him after. I didn't get to go backstage. I was pissed, but, you know, it kind of I had to be outside. But just seeing him on stage, and then he brought out Hasan Minhaj, and he brought Jay Sean, if you remember Jay Sean back in the day.
Yeah.
And he brought these guys out, and that was like, and in the back they had like the founder of Vice, who's another brown dude. And again, like, people who are listening to this who aren't from my background might be like, why does it matter that much? But honestly, even for me, who kind of like is almost like resistant to that thing, where I'm like, you know, I have friends from everywhere, I don't want to just hang out with brown people, but there is a feeling of, oh man, like that is sick, you know, like the fact he's on stage, he's won an Oscar now, and he's gone, you know, we knew him, but when he was on the come up, there's this feeling of like he's one of us, you know. In the same way in football, I always relay it back to football, when Bukayo Saka and Emil Smith Rowe are scoring goals for Arsenal, you're like, oh, they were there since they were 9 years old, they're Arsenal fans, they get it, like they're one of us. And it is just like a great feeling, and I think Jamal really like embodied that for a lot of us. And I was very, very sad when he passed away recently, so RIP to him, man.
He was like one of those people that like my mum saw, like, you know, in the newspaper or something like that, and be like, oh, this is, you know, do you know this guy? It was first like, oh, do you know this guy? Have you heard of him? Who is he? He's doing stuff on the internet too. Like, you must know him. And then I was like, yeah, like this is what it is. And then obviously, not obviously, but just over the journey of the last like 10 years, my mom was like, oh, Skepta's in the newspaper. Like, or this person's on the news. Like, or this artist or Lady Leisha, or this person.
You've worked with, right? Is that?
Yeah, yeah.
She knew that, yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you'd come to shows, or people would come to the house, and then they would be like stars. And then like, just for the olders, they're like, oh, you actually did it. Like, that's, they're gassed. They're like, oh my God.
We were giving
like,
them cups
amazing.
Of tea. Now they're on GQ magazine and selling like all this crazy stuff. That's amazing.
Exactly. Because it wasn't like, this wasn't like meant to be in that way. Like, it was made. Like, and I think that bit, like our, you know, UK culture, like, hasn't forgotten yet. Like, it's still, people are still taking pleasure in seeing people do well. Like, I think in America, it's more like, oh, of course you went to college and then got to the NBA. Like, there is like a bit more of a tradition of that
like
trajectory.
Like a pipeline almost.
Yeah. But here in the UK, like, things are that more short term, like a bit, not flash in the pan. That's like a really rude way of saying it. But, oh, you have a song like 1 year and then next year no one's heard of you again. Like, that was the history of like a lot of our, you know, music in the mainstream. But now people are staying for like 5, 10, 15 years and doing stuff way broader than what anyone could have imagined for them. You know what I'm saying? So
it's amazing, it's nice. Man. Got to celebrate that, man. Is there anyone else you want to give a shout out to? Before, like, meaning the people that we were talking about who have come from that scene.
The I guess like the Rinse FM incubator, like Screamer Banga.
Yeah, of course. Okay, they're dubstep crazy, right?
Yeah, dubstep legends, Screamer Banga, KEB.
What's that song? Like, Night, is it?
Night.
Yeah, that's a classic. Okay.
Screaming Bangers. Katie B was like she is like amazing singer. That kind of came out through dubstep and UK funky and all that music, and is like, yeah, again, a star. Like, this presenter, Maya Drama, who's like a presenter.
Oh,
in the
yeah,
UK
of course.
Here.
Oh, was she on Rinse as well?
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Oh, yeah. She was also, if people follow pop culture, she was with Stormzy for a while, right? But yeah, she seems hilarious and super fun.
Yeah, so she's on the TV, I think, still all the time. Like, I don't watch television anymore, but she was like presenting big shows here. Who else was on there? Like, just I guess the alumni, just because it's been there for 20 something years.
Yeah.
Like Dizzy Rascal, all these people, Wiley, JME. I don't know. There's loads. There's like hundreds of people have passed through there. It's like a generational thing.
That's amazing, man.
So, and it's like this tiny room in, well, it was a tiny room in Brick Lane,
That's crazy. Love it, man. Well, listen, bro, we've spoken about so much stuff today. I really appreciate you going deep on all of that. We went in directions I didn't know we were going to go, so this was really, really fun.
That's okay.
Is there anything else before we close out that you wanted to share with people, apart from make the thing?
I think that's the mission. That's it, pretty much.
That should be the slogan for Creator Lab too, man. If we ever do, we need to do a collaboration or something, like maybe a live event. We'll figure it out. But even if it's just doing this in person or something, I think we'll figure it out. But
straight up,
it's definitely the same ethos, man. So I appreciate it. All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate you. And when I'm in London, we'll definitely link up as well. And if you're ever out in New York, let me know. We will take you out here. Have a good time, man. And if you're new here, appreciate you being here, and make sure you're subscribed on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, all the usual places, and share this with your friends. If you're from the UK especially, you've got to big us up here and share this with people to get this out there to people. This is a nice link up in the making. So thanks again for being here. Appreciate you, and see you on the next one. Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/CreatorLabFM. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, BZAIDI, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.